This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
That would mean we would cross pretty much every tipping point that's been devised, and we'd be on an irrevocable path to an ice-free planet, which would completely transform the conditions of life. You know, those scientists who spend their lives working on climate science, they are terrified.
We go to Australia now to talk with Clive Hamilton. He's a professor of public ethics supported by the Australian National University and the University of Melbourne. Clive is lighting up the media with a fantastic new series on climate denial, plus his controversial new book, Requiem for Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. Clive, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's a pleasure.
People down under may know you, Clive, but I think you've sprung out as a bit of a surprise to North American audiences. When did your article in Scientific American come out?
It appeared last week, but it followed a series of pieces I had on the ABC website, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, so the public radio stations here. And it was a series of articles that ran over 5 days, which was really analysing and exposing the state of denial around the world and the sort of tactics, some of which were pretty grubby, that are being used now.
Why would you take on this nest of hornets?
Because I'm scared. I'm worried about the way in which the global debate, particularly in North America and Australia, is going backwards. We've seen a huge gap open up between what the scientists are telling us about climate change, and even in the last 5 or 6 months since the so-called Climategate scandal broke, the leaked emails from the University of East Anglia. Even in that period, a series of new research studies have appeared which make the future look much more ominous and frightening, and yet we have a very successful campaign by denialists who are persuading the general public that climate change is either exaggerated or doesn't exist. And so we should be very, very worried about this fact, because if we're not going to take seriously this enormous threat to our future, then we really are in a dire situation.
I get whiplash when I try to follow the scene down there in Australia. I mean, we've had terrible fires I've read about, and the droughts and the floods. You think, well, surely these are the people that are going to get it if anybody does, and a new government gets elected promising big things, but then the coal exports keep on growing. What is going on in Australia?
Well, that's a very good question. When the Rudd government was elected, the Labor government, 2 years ago, after 11, 12 years of the Howard Conservative government, which on the surface admitted there was that climate change is real but refused to do anything about it. When the government changed, we all expected that Kevin Rudd, the new Prime Minister, would live up to his rhetoric. He said that climate change is the greatest moral challenge of our generation. And yet we've seen from those early months a constant process of backtracking, to the point where, particularly with the failure of Copenhagen, the government really wants to not talk about climate change at all. And what was most alarming in this country was the way in which the Conservative Party, which here is called the Liberal Party, elected as their leader in December a man who described climate change as absolute crap. So we now have climate denialists who are in charge of the opposition and therefore provide the alternative government and the alternative prime minister of the nation. But as you say, Australia is the developed country most likely to suffer the effects of climate change over the coming decades. We had monumental bushfires, catastrophic bushfires, a bit over a year ago in Victoria with 200 people killed. So it really is a mystery, and I think it speaks to the extraordinary capacity that humans have to filter out or deny the facts when they're inconvenient or too frightening to acknowledge.
Well, you know, it only took one snowstorm in Washington, D.C. to knock over this whole climate scam. That's what we're being told. And even the Wall Street Journal comes out and says that ClimateGate has proven that there really is no problem. Unbelievable.
Well, anyone who listens to a climate scientist realizes that this is a terrible situation to find ourselves in. And it also reflects an astonishing degree of ignorance that people confuse constantly the weather with the climate, the weather being the day-to-day, week-to-week change in the conditions around us, the climate representing the long-term trends. And to suggest that one snowstorm or a bad winter undermines, you know, decades of data and climate science showing that the planet is warming and that human emissions of greenhouse gases are responsible for it is really, what we're witnessing is a sort of new creationism, in the sense that we have a whole group of people who are now politically and ideologically invested in denying the truth of the science. Just as in creationism, people's pre-established belief set is enough for them to repudiate a vast accumulation of scientific evidence. Exactly the same is now happening with the repudiation of climate change for political and ideological reasons.
Yes, I know. You know, I get in hate mail, I guess I could call it, or aggressive emails from individuals who aren't really connected to any company, as far as I can tell. They seem to have turned their personal disappointment and fears into net attacks. What can you tell us about the psychology of hate that has arisen around this climate issue?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and it's something that I led off with in the first of my five articles about the extraordinary rise of cyberbullying directed particularly against climate scientists, but also directed to journalists, commentators, climate campaigners, and really anyone who is worried about climate change and says so. But we've seen climate scientists in Australia, and of course this is happening in North America as well and in Britain, receive every time they go on in public and say something about their research on climate change, an interview or a news article, they are generally deluged with very aggressive and abusive and sometimes threatening emails, mostly from anonymous sources. So there's a small but extremely angry group of people out there who feel personally affronted at anyone talking about climate change, and they try to bully climate scientists and others into silence. And to the point where some climate scientists and campaigners have felt compelled to call the police because they felt personally threatened by some of these emails. And I think it's a mistake to attribute, as some people have, this denialist campaign to the fossil fuel companies, as though those leading the denialist cause are really tools of Exxon. And there's no doubt that Exxon and the coal companies in the US in particular have been providing funding to right-wing think tanks in the United States and in Canada and in Australia and indeed Europe. And that those think tanks are very important at providing, as it were, the raw material, the disinformation that gets circulated. But really it's an ideological political movement now of a substantial number of ordinary folk who, for one reason or another, have taken up the denialist cause. And here in Australia, there's quite a close parallel between this denialist movement and the people who swarmed around a political leader who emerged a few years ago called Pauline Hanson. It was really stimulated racist fears and the concerns of those Australians who felt shut out by the process of globalization and ruled over by elites in the capital cities. And that's very much been the case in the United States as well. It's no accident that Christopher Monckton, the British climate skeptic extraordinaire, who's a superb performer but is unashamed to tell lies over and over again, it's no surprise that he should be going to Washington to address a Tea Party rally. There's a very close alliance between that sort of inchoate rage which comes from the far right of the Republican Party and the rage of the denialists. Those two political trends are really merging into one.
And we just heard from Professor Stephen Schneider that Senator Inhofe is wanting to charge him and other scientists of the IPCC with some sort of crime for lying to Congress or something. It's gotten bizarre to the point where you could see if the elections change in 2010 and the Republicans come back in power, maybe we could have a return to McCarthyism and investigations of scientists.
Well, the accusation of McCarthyism has been thrown around for many years, and it's usually a warning and an exaggeration. But here, this is a truly chilling development that scientists who've been going about their work in a diligent way for many years should now become targeted by a powerful U.S. senator suggesting that they should be investigated for criminal activities. I mean, it takes your breath away. But it's not just Inhofe in the U.S. Senate. In the so-called flyover states, those states in the central part of the United States, they're called flyover states because the people who live there, particularly on the right, believe that the rulers of the country just fly over them from the East Coast to the West Coast and always looking down on them. But some of them are now expressing this, that their legislatures are dominated by climate deniers. So, for example, South Dakota, their House of Representatives passed a resolution a week or two ago calling for denialism to be taught in South Dakota schools alongside climate science. And so, you know, that both sides of the debate, as if there were a genuine scientific debate. And the parallels, of course, with creationism are very obvious. The call to teach anti-science alongside established science. So it really, and when you read some of the debates that went ahead in the legislature around that, you realize that there's a monster on the loose associated with this climate denial organization. And I think it's going to get very, very ugly. And I hope that Inhofe's outrageous proposal stimulates people of goodwill to realize that this is something very dangerous and must be resisted from the outset.
Well, Stephen Schneider was rather sad that he hadn't had a lot of time to spend with the students in his classrooms because he's been having to handle so much of this, and we're seeing abuse of freedom of information requests and these government paperwork. It's a blatant attempt to tie up all the time of research scientists. Surely we can't let climate science stall at such a critical time.
Well, and yet that is exactly the objective of the denialist campaign. It now seems to be very well coordinated, and we've covered some of the tactics being used, the attack by Inhofe, the bombarding of climate science organizations with freedom of information requests, which are generally vexatious and designed to tie up the scientists and their organizations. But also, and this is another thing I talked about in my series of articles, there's now evidence of what might be called black ops by people associated or organizations associated with the climate denial movement. The hacking of the computer system at the University of East Anglia is a best-known example. But there in Canada, at one of your universities, at University of Victoria, I think it was, there's a climate research center. And two people dressed as and presenting themselves as computer technicians attempted to talk their way in order, assumed, to hack into the computer there so that they would get access to information. In addition, in the United States, someone has hired private investigators to rifle through the rubbish bins of environmental organizations. They're sending spies in to environmental groups to disrupt and report back. So there really seems to be quite a systematic campaign of disruption, not only of the scientists, but of environment groups campaigning on the issue.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Clive Hamilton, you have a new book out with the title Requiem for a Species. A requiem used to mean a mass for the deceased, and I'm presuming the species you mention is us. Why did you pick this title?
Well, right about 18 months ago, I've been working on climate change for 15 or more years. And I've always recognised sort of intellectually that we face a very serious problem. But about 18 months ago, I picked up a couple of new research articles and one or two books that had come out. And one in particular set out the task that we face and what would be necessary for the world to do in order to have a reasonable chance at limiting warming to 2 degrees, which, as you know, is now regarded as dangerous. And the analysis showed that even with an optimistic set of assumptions about when the world's greenhouse gas emissions will reach a peak and the rate that they would decline thereafter, even if we make optimistic assumptions, let's say that we assume that emissions globally peak in 2020 and decline globally at 3% or so per annum thereafter, which isn't going to happen, incidentally, particularly after Copenhagen, but let's assume something happens and we do that, that would leave the world warming to 4 degrees centigrade. Now, 4 degrees centigrade is an average that means 7 or 8 degrees on land, and that would mean we would cross pretty much every tipping point that's been devised, and we'd be on an irrevocable path to an ice-free planet, which would completely transform the conditions of life. And that's it in a nutshell. Now, that's the optimistic assumption, if you really look at and listen to what the scientists are saying. And then if you talk informally to climate scientists, as I have last October, for example, I went to a conference in Oxford in the UK, which was called The World at 4 degrees. And this is something the scientists have never done before, to actually openly contemplate what it would be like if the world did warm on average by 4 degrees, bearing in mind it's warmed by only about 0.8 degrees at present. And, you know, those scientists who spend their lives working on climate science, they are terrified. They see the situation as being so dire that it's impossible to see any international or national processes politically bringing about the sorts of policies that would induce this rapid decline, very rapid and urgent decline in greenhouse gases. And therefore, we are virtually committed to a transformed planet which will be much less friendly to life, including human life. So I think that we really do, and this is what the book does, have to rethink the entire future of humanity. So that's why I chose that title, Requiem for a Species.
Well, if we're going to survive, there must be a route out of this madness. Do you have some ideas how we can get past the denial, the intentional blindness, and these reactive emotions?
First of all, I think we have to recognize that the debate, so-called, although it seems to be about the science, is not really about the science. We're now talking about much deeper ideological issues, questions of identity, and fears about and conceptions about the future. So I think we have to shift the whole debate away from the science. Of course, the scientific evidence needs to continue to be produced and put out there in the public domain. But I think we have to understand that denialists are driven by something quite different, and that the general public wants to believe what denialists are saying. I mean, who wants to accept that we're headed for a very grim future and that it's going to threaten everything that we've come to know and love about planet Earth? And so the general public is sort of ripe to be persuaded that there's nothing too much to worry about. And so I think we really have to confront that as well. Look, I'm arguing in this book on the basis of the science that we just have to accept the fact that we are not going to be able to avoid transforming the conditions of life on the planet. That doesn't mean we should just accept it and do nothing, of course. In fact, I say we should be much more active as a result, demanding that our political leaders take the sorts of actions that it can at least defer some of the worst effects. And also starting to have a political debate about what might be called democratizing survivability, because as this climate disruption comes upon us in the next decades, what we'll see is wealthy people taking measures to try to protect themselves and ensure their comfort and future, and poor people, both in rich countries and in poor countries, suffering the results. And so I think it's a real challenge to the democratic system in those countries that have them to try to make sure that the burden is spread more evenly as we go into this different world over the next decades.
Well, Clive, as we wrap up, is there something that I've missed or a message that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, only this, that in a way, what we're seeing is an unwinding of the whole Enlightenment project. We came to believe, we as humans, that after millennia of living in darkness and superstition, 300 or so years ago, we came into this period of light where the power of reason would allow us to consider, assess the circumstances we face and make decisions in our own interest. And what we're seeing now is a repudiation of the Enlightenment, because science, the greatest child of the Enlightenment, is now being overruled by deeper passions. And so it really does represent a very profound, I think, transformation of humanity, not just in our material conditions of life, but also in the way we think of ourselves as being. So we're really entering a new age, and we have to face up to that.
Our guest has been Clive Hamilton. Find his hard-hitting five-part series on climate denial at abc.au.net and in Scientific American, dated March 1, 2010. And look for his new book, Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change. Clive, thank you so much for sharing your busy day with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if a woman can survive, they may find.
The year 2525, if man is still alive.